This episode contains depictions of violence that some may find triggering or disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. It's been so long. We're back. Took a little break there.
Yeah. The needed break. How are you doing?
Yeah, we did. We really did. Yes, well, I'll explain why I needed it. I've talked about my 18-year-old Yorkie Twix, and he has unfortunately crossed the Rainbow Bridge as of a few days ago. So, yeah, pretty tough past few days.
Yeah,
very, very tough. I just couldn't do it. I'm sure y'all understand why, especially if you have pets yourselves.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, how was the break for you?
I feel like I've just been kind of a mess.
Yeah.
Just all kinds of things kept coming up. It feels like every facet there's been something.
Mm-hmm.
Our fridge died overnight.
Oh, that sucks.
First we knew there was kind of an issue, but it seemed okay. But then overnight it just went out, and so we had to throw away all our food. And it was the morning of a joint baby shower that we had to go to for two of my cousins.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to rush to, like, get ready for that and clean up the water and get rid of all the food and figure out getting a new fridge. And just there was a lot going on all at once. And this was something that, though I love my cousins, we weren't, like, the most excited to go to this.
Yeah.
It was kind of like a celebration for... So I have six cousins.
Uh-huh.
Five of which are partnered off. So we celebrated two engagements and had a baby shower for two others. And then there was a third person who's pregnant, and it wasn't her baby shower, but they had like a congratulations for you too. And then my grandma and I are the only other couple.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just a very awkward congratulations all around, but like
and zip. None for Gretchen Wieners.
Yes, and then at the very end, we went to, like, say goodbye to people, and I got some very quiet, like, good lucks. And it took me a second to be like, what? For what?
And then
I realized, and I was like, are you fucking kidding me? So, like, that's when you want to address that you know, like, it's not a secret.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a secret. I would have loved, like, I don't know. So, like, emotionally... I've been in that place. We're coming up on our next IVF cycle, and all the anxiety is coming back, and it's much more expensive this time around. Mm-hmm. The first round of medication is $7,000, and there's going to be at least a few thousand more.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah. And then working that out with work.
Yes. Yeah.
I thought we were all good, and now I got an email where I'm like, wait a second, are we not? So, and I got a jury summons.
Oh, God.
So, it's just, you know.
What a Mercury retrograde.
And our chicken Mabel died.
Oh.
I found her. She wasn't doing well. I knew she was getting old. And I kind of was cradling her, and I thought, well, I'll bring her into the garage because she just doesn't seem happy.
Yeah.
And then she just, while I'm holding her, she died.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So that was just it's been a lot.
Yeah.
It's been a lot. And it's not slowing down yet. I hear this thing ends in a few days, so we'll see.
Yeah.
If that's really it. Because I think I'm good.
Wow.
I think I'm ready to be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've definitely, you know, had my fill as well. And I haven't even had as much as you.
You had a big fill, though.
Yeah, I got just one big whammy.
Yeah.
One big whammy. It was very nice, though, that we were... Not that the experience was nice, but as far as, like, under the circumstances, we were able to do at-home euthanasia. Mm-hmm. And we put him, like, kind of literally on a pedestal. There's this ottoman that when he was able to jump up, it was his favorite spot to, like, curl up and nap when he would nap downstairs. And we laid him on that, and we just all surrounded him, and...
That's beautiful.
Just it was traumatic for sure for all of us. I've been struggling a lot for sure. I mean, it's only been a few days. It was Saturday, today is Tuesday. And this dog was part of my life for 18 years.
Yeah. So long.
And he was my dog. I mean, he was like my mom's dog. Like, he chose her as his person. Whatever. I was a very close second, though. I was a very close second. I'm still going through the thing of, like, having a hard time going downstairs. Because, I mean, in his old age, he was just downstairs, living downstairs. He didn't go upstairs at all. Where I just, like, still expect to see him, or I think I see him out of the corner of my eye, or I'll even be up here working in my room and my door will be open and it'll sound like him, like his nails scratching on the hardwood downstairs, like different stuff like that. It's really, really tough. And the spot where his bed used to be is just now very empty.
Yeah.
So, anyways, not to unload, you know, everything on y'all, we will, and I am not sure if I can handle any more talking about it, but we'll get straight into this episode. So, anywho, welcome to the New Witches. I'm Maria.
I'm Laura.
And this is our spooky episode. I am covering true crime. Laura has paranormal. This time around.
Yes.
For anyone new to the podcast, you'll notice that we switch themes. So we'll do spooky one week where we'll cover true crime / paranormal. And then the next week we'll do witchy. And then we, you know, stagger back and forth like that. And then Laura and I take turns as well on paranormal and true crime. So we'll switch it up. And I do believe we have new Patreon members to shout out. Oh my gosh.
We do. We
have guys.
Why? I'm not in a meeting. We have Alejandra and Emily.
Thank you so much.
And Allison. Oh my gosh. I don't think we got three. Shout her out.
Oh my God. Wow. It has been three since last week. Okay. Wow. Thank you so much. Y'all, like, again, it just means so much. It helps us do what we do, it helps us also to invest back into the show, make a better show for you guys, create content, all that good stuff. Make sure we have, you know, the best equipment, and, you know, we just appreciate it so much. Like, oh my God.
I know.
Thank you. It's
my head's still wrapping around it.
Yeah.
So many so quickly.
So this episode is brought to you by those three, Emily, Alejandra, and Allison. Sorry. I don't have the names in front of me, so that was just from memory. But yeah, y'all rock.
The rest of that song.
Also, happy Pride.
Yes, happy Pride.
Happy Pride. I have chosen. So my true crime is kind of true crime light. Because I chose to talk about Marsha P. Johnson.
Love it.
We're going to talk about her life and death. There's not much to go on with her death. Like, I'll talk about it, obviously, and wrap up the topic with that. Like, we'll still touch on true crime. It's not like there's no true crime. But
right.
because there's so little of it, just because her death was not investigated enough, and because she was just a freaking badass, I'm going to talk mostly about her life and her influence on the LGBTQ plus community. So here you go. You're about to be schooled. So a little background. So Marsha P. Johnson was born Malcolm Michaels Jr. in 1945. She went by both Marsha and Malcolm. It was kind of like this duo personality that she went by. It's not, you know, so Malcolm isn't necessarily her dead name, but because she identified with either name fluidly during her life. And for the purpose of consistency in this episode, I'm going to refer to her as Marsha and use she, her pronouns. But know that Marsha also fluidly went by Malcolm and he, him.
Okay.
But I'm just going to stick to Marsha, she, her, just so that we can all keep it aligned. So according to Susan Stryker, who is a professor of human gender and sexuality studies at the University of Arizona, Marsha's gender expression could perhaps most accurately be called gender nonconforming. So Marsha never self-identified with the term transgender, but also you have to consider that the term wasn't really like broadly in use during the time Marsha was alive.
Right.
And we'll talk about that. I mean, she did self-identify as gay, as a transvestite, which is weird to say because I feel like we just don't use that word anymore. And it's kind of like...
We've grown,
but that was the terminology used back then. That's what she identified as. And she also, of course, identified as a queen, referring to drag queen or street queen. She was an American gay liberation activist, and she's known as an outspoken advocate for gay rights. She's one of the prominent figures in the Stonewall Uprising of 1969, which is pretty much the reason we have Pride to begin with.
Yeah, it is, for sure.
So that's just like a really quick little in a nutshell. Digging deeper, so her early life, Marsha was born, as I said, Malcolm Michaels Jr., on August 24th, 1945, in Elizabeth, New Jersey. She was the fifth.
She was a Virgo.
Yes, she was.
I love it.
And she was,
go my
get team. This, the fifth of seven children. That's a lot of siblings. Dang. A lot of siblings. So her father, Malcolm Michael Sr., was an assembly line worker at General Motors. And her mom, Alberta Claiborne, was a housekeeper. So they were pretty religious. They attended an African Methodist Episcopal church during Marsha's childhood. And they were, like, pretty devoutly religious in later in life. Or, I mean, she was Marsha. Oh, my gosh. I'm getting all tongue-tied already. She also rather took an interest into Catholicism. She made offerings to saints on a in a very personal manner. She actually kept a private altar at home. So, you know, Catholics, the witchiest of the Christians, I should say. That's what I think. Anyways, I'm pretty witchy. So Marsha first began wearing dresses at age 5. So she knew pretty early on that she was at least like pretty gender fluid and very curious, about, her femininity, but unfortunately she had to stop temporarily because of course she was being like harassed and bullied by boys in the neighborhood. In a 1992 interview, Marsha described being the young victim of sexual assault by an adolescent boy at age 12. Oh. Yeah, she was like, I had no idea what sex even was, and she thought of herself at the time as, quote, married to Jesus. So, I mean, she just has a really, really strong, close relationship with the big guy, And this was very, very traumatic for her. However, it did kind of open her eyes to her own sexuality. From this point on, the idea of being gay was like a some sort of dream, as she put it, rather than something that seemed possible. And so she actually chose to remain sexually inactive until leaving for New York City at age 17. So Marsha's mom reportedly said that being homosexual is like being, quote, lower than a dog. But Marsha said that Alberta was unaware of the LGBT community. And what's funny, too, is that Marsha did have family. Like, obviously, you know, the immediate family kind of firstly knew her as Malcolm. He, him.
Right.
But there were family members that did address her as Marsha. So it was like this thing where they like knew that Marsha was gender fluid, but they weren't okay with, you know, being part of the LGBTQ plus community.
Yeah.
So Marsha attended Edison High School, which is now called Thomas A. Edison Career and Technical Academy, and that's in Elizabeth. She graduated in 1963. And so, as I said, she left home at 17, moved to New York City. She had $15 to her name and one bag of clothing. Like, she was just ready for a new chapter. And just, like, right. Holy crap. People who have stories like that, I just can't, you know, like, oh, we came, like, you know, we came to America with, like, $4 to our name. And you're like, what?
How?
It's very, very brave. It was a very, very brave thing to do. Yeah. I think, you know, she was probably just ready to, like, leave that small town behind. So this move to New York City would obviously catapult the rest of her life. After Marsha began hanging out with the street hustlers near the Howard Johnson's restaurant at 6th Avenue and 8th Street, Marsha's life changed. She came out and said, quote, "My life has been built around sex and gay liberation, being a drag queen, and sex work." At first, she was homeless. I mean, like, she only had $15 to her name.
Right.
So she was homeless. She slept in this movie theater. She engaged in survival sex to make money, to find a place to stay, to eat, all of that. People who knew Marsha were like, wow, this was a really rough time of her life, but... And we're not really sure how she got through it, but this was also the time of her life where she found her people. Like, she found her tribe. She let her true colors shine through. So this was obviously a really important time in her life. She eventually moved to Greenwich Village in 1966. And for those of you who don't know, Greenwich Village was a huge epicenter for the LGBTQ plus community. And was a place they just could all be in their element. They celebrated who they were. They were just together as a community. It was just like, you know, a safe-ish place. Because, I mean, obviously, we're talking about, you know, the 60s here. But right. This is where they congregated and found safety in their community. This is also when Marsha really got into drag. And she has said that she wasn't able to really invest in her dragging as much as she wanted. Like, she didn't really do a lot of, like, what's called, like, high drag, or which is, like, the very elaborate, like, stage like costumes. You know, she did have drag costumes, but
like RuPaul style,
exactly, like the highest drag level race. Just grade A, you know, resources to do all of that makeup and outfits and stuff. Like, she didn't have that. She didn't have a lot of money. But she absolutely loved it. And even though money was a huge issue, what she did have, she spent really frugally. And then any extra would go towards materials for her to make her signature outfits. She was also really, really resourceful. So she received leftover flowers after sleeping under tables that were used for sorting flowers in the Flower District of Manhattan. And she was known for wearing crowns of fresh flowers. Like, you can often see her depicted in her flower crowns. She was very, very resourceful. And She was tall, slender, often dressed in like flowing robes, shiny dresses. She loved red plastic high heels, wore bright wigs. Like, she just always drew attention with her drag outfits. She was known for designing her outfits to reflect both the masculine and the feminine parts of her. Because, again, she's, like, gender nonconforming. So mm-hmm. her goal was always to show both sides of her. And also, she lived also still identifying as Malcolm.
Right.
And it was kind of this pendulum where there were times where she was only ever Marsha. And then there was this, like, kind of like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, not to make one good or bad or better or worse than the other. But when she did...
Like Dr. Jekyll and Dr. Jekyll.
Kind of. But
Dr. Jekyll and Mrs. Jekyll.
Now, like, Marsha was known for being, like, a total sweetheart, but when she was, like, in her bouts of identifying more as Malcolm, she even, like, would use a deeper voice and was a lot more aggressive, and she even got kicked out of a lot of bars and was banned from a lot of establishments. Like, it was this alter ego. Like, when she was Malcolm, she was just, like, taking nobody's shit and was rather, like, aggressive and even burned some bridges with some people, but is mostly otherwise known as kind of being this sweetheart, kind of saintly person. But that was more her, like, Marsha persona. So, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, she was always kind of, like, embracing her duality, which I love. So she started under the moniker Black Marsha as her, like, you know, stage name, but she later decided on the drag queen name Marsha P. Johnson. She took Johnson from the restaurant Howard Johnson's on 42nd Street. And she, this is funny. She said that the P stood for pay it no mind. And she used she used the phrase sarcastically when questioned about gender, saying it stands for pay it no mind. Marsha sang and performed as a member of Jay Camisia's international New York City based drag performance troupe Hot Peaches. I'm like, I love that name. So, really cool troupe. They, like, went all over the place. So she was a member from 1972 through to shows in, like, even the 1990s, and they got to travel all over the world. They even, like, went to London, Europe. I mean, even though she was, like, living very, very, like, impoverished, like, she was still, mm-hmm. like, attending these, not attending, just performing these awesome shows. And in 1975, she was photographed by Andy Warhol.
Oh, wow.
And the crazy thing is, she wasn't even, like, famous or anything at this time. She was photographed, and this photograph was included in this collection of Polaroids that's called Ladies and Gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
So check that out. Marsha was known for her kindness. Again, she was so sweet. Everyone wanted to be around her. She was known as this magnetic person people always gravitated to, and with reason, because Marsha was the shit. She was the best. I wish I could have known her. Like, the way she's described in my research, I feel like I do know her. And it's just, I think, exemplary of how she was just light in the world and people saw it. Of course, she had her own darkness that she carried with her, and we'll touch on that. But she just shined wherever she went. So Marsha was known as the mayor of Christopher Street due to her welcoming presence in the streets of Greenwich Village. And Christopher Street obviously is in Greenwich Village. She was just kind of like, I don't know, like this ambassador, and she was super sweet and made every, like, she took people under her wing. So Christopher Street was her stomping grounds. That's where her home was. It was also where Stonewall Inn was. So in the 1960s, a lot of the members of the LGBTQ plus community were not allowed in any bars. In fact, just being gay was illegal. I'm sure no one's surprised by that. Raids were super common. Like, it just happened left and right. Police would bust into bars. and just, you know, charge establishments and arrest people for serving or hosting members of the LGBTQ plus community. People would even get arrested just for dancing with someone of the same sex. Like, you're not even doing anything really sexual. Like, you could just be, like, drunk and you're dancing with your dude celebrating, and if a cop sees you, you get arrested and you're charged with sexual deviance. Like, this also would happen if someone considered to be male was found dressed in women's clothes. They would also be charged with sexual deviance charges. Establishments could be fined for this, like for hosting this, you know, behavior or serving said people, you know, from the LGBT plus community. They could be fined. They could even just be straight shut down.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just shut down. It was super common. So the Stonewall Inn was owned by the Genovese crime family. Or I guess it's Genovese. It's one of the oldest and largest of the five families that dominate organized crime in New York and New Jersey. I mean, I feel like...
Oh, wow.
If you're, you know, if you ever heard of the five families, like, if you know, you know. The mafia saw a business opportunity in the gay community. And it's really interesting just how woven the mafia is in the gay community, especially during this time. So,
which I love, because the latest thing is, instead of doing the whole acronym, a lot of people just shorthand Alphabet Mafia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I kind of love that connection.
So they were like, okay, so the gay community, they need a place to just be able to drink and be served. Like, they're all dying to just be welcomed in some sort of establishment and to, like, let their hair down and be who they are. So the Genovese family were more than happy to offer them underground bars for them to be themselves at a price, of course. So the Stonewall Inn was designed to be a private BYOB bar. Which is, I think, kind of an interesting concept. So people would come in, they bring their own, like, they would pay to be able to just bring their own alcohol to be able to drink and hang out,
like,
with their friends.
An indoor park.
Pretty much, yeah. They, like, even made it all exclusive, making them sign a guest book to be able to get in. But really, it's like, honestly, you just pay, like, the cover charge and, like, you're in. As long as you're willing to pay, you know. That's it. And it became, yeah, like, the go-to place in the gay community. Like, that's where you went. But yeah, as long as you had the money to spend, the mafia didn't give a fuck who you have sex with, which should be the case for everybody.
Right.
Marsha was one of the first drag queens to go to the Stonewall Inn after they began allowing women and drag queens inside. So it was originally a gay men-only bar. And then they finally opened it to, like, lesbians and queens. At the time, drag queens weren't really welcome in the gay bars. And it's really funny. And it's something, honestly, that I did not know much until I started doing more of this research. They were just really, like, the black sheep of the LGBT plus community. So one of Marsha's BFFs, Sylvia, I almost said Plath, Sylvia Plath, Sylvia Rivera, she once demonstrated at this, like, festival or rally or something, and she went on stage and she's like, you're like, brothers and sisters need your help, like, help us get them out of jail, this and that, because obviously, like, they were being arrested for cross-dressing and whatever. And this is in a crowd of LGB, and she was booed off stage just to let, you know, like, just to paint the picture of how welcome or really unwelcome trans and, you know, drag queens people were within the LGBT plus community at this time. So cops were very often bought off by the mafia, as you would guess, and they would tip them off when they knew that there was a police raid that was about to go down. However, This time, in the early hours of June 28th, 1969, police showed up at the Stonewall Inn completely unannounced. They arrested around 13 people. They beat countless others and even had female... This part, like, pisses me the fuck off. Like, this is just, like, a monstrous to me. They had female officers take female-seeming patrons into the bathroom to verify their sex. Ugh. They're like, oh, you're a woman? Show me your vagina.
Right.
No one has the fucking right to ask you to verify your sex or gender. I don't fucking care.
No.
Like, it's just...
The only person who sees your genitals is your doctor when you have made an appointment to do so. Or your, you know, sexual partner.
Exactly.
When they have your permission.
Exactly.
Once again.
And your mama and papa, or mama and papa when you're a baby. And that's it.
And even then, I got in this weird habit. Anytime I have to change a little baby's diaper, I've always, like, talk them through it. Like, it's all cool. Like, it's not a big deal. I just have to do this. Because you can't do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And we're almost done.
Yep. Bear with me. But yeah, no, I mean, just absolutely horrendous. So the riots reportedly started at around 1:20 a.m. after Storme de Larverie fought back against the police officer who attempted to arrest her that night. So Storme was a butch lesbian. She was just fucking, oh my God. Like, even I'm like looking at her, I'm like, you are cute. I mean, she was real. I don't know. I just loved her style. Like, I don't know. My heart fluttered a little bit when I saw her photo. But she...
What was her name again? I'm going to look up the picture.
Storme de Larverie.
Storme?
Yeah, it's like an E with an accent and de Larverie in the French way with an IE at the end. But yeah, so she got hit over the head with a billy club. And she's, like, bleeding from her head. Once she got hit, she yelled at the crowd of patrons, why don't you guys do something? And that's when the raid became a rebellion and people started fighting back with police. They're like, fuck Jesus. Yeah. The crowd started chanting, gay power, we shall overcome. They started throwing beer bottles, glasses, like, really anything that they could get their hands on within, you know, their surroundings. They threw it at the police, and it got, like, so dangerous that the police actually took cover from the uprising. They went into the Stonewall Inn, ironically, bringing with them, like, the people they arrested, because they just still wanted to hold them. And that's when someone set the Stonewall building on fire. It's unsure if the person who did this was a police officer or someone in the angry crowd of people, but a lot of people speculate that it was one of the officers who did it, which I'm not quite sure, like, how that logic checks out. But anyways, the fire department...
We know officers are not logical people.
Yeah, who knows? So the fire department gets there. They're able to save the building. They get everyone inside of it, you know, safe and sound. But we're just scratching the surface here. Like, that's not even, like, the worst of it. Like, this was, like, a catalyst. So Marsha P. Johnson was 23 at the time that the Stonewall Uprising happened. And she is considered one of the first people to start the resistance, which is actually debated. Like, people just consider her as, like, oh, she was there, like, right in the beginning when it, like, turned into this uprising. But even she, like, I'll say later, she was like, no, I wasn't actually there at that moment. She has been named, along with Zazu Nova and Jackie Hormona, by a number of the Stonewall veterans interviewed by David Carter in his book Stonewall, The Riots That Sparked the Gay Revolution, as being, quote, three individuals known to have been in the vanguard of the pushback against the police at the uprising. So Carter is, like, this Stonewall historian, and he writes that someone reported that fellow Stonewall veterans and gay activists such as Morty Manford and Marty Robinson had told them that on the first night, Johnson, quote, threw a shot glass at a mirror in the Torch bar screaming, I got my civil rights! which who knows if that actually happened. While the first two nights of the rioting were by far the most intense, the clashes with police would result in a series of spontaneous demonstrations and marches through the gay neighborhoods of Greenwich Village for about, like, almost a week afterwards. Mm-hmm. So it really just, like, was a catalyst for just all of this anger, you know? I mean, like, they were making demonstrations. Yeah. The LGBTQ plus community was coming together. They were there to raise awareness and tell people, like, we're fucking here and we're not going anywhere. Like, we exist. Mm-hmm. We're allowed to exist. We have the same human rights as other people do. So the first Pride March, which would occur a year later on the anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, happened because of the people who fought back, and Marsha was one of the most influential people involved in it. So Robin Souza told the Gay Activist Alliance shortly afterwards that it, quote, was the shot glass that was heard around the world, unquote. But again, who knows if that actually was Marsha? Mm-hmm. It's really heavily disputed, this like whole shot glass thing. So before Carter wrote this book, it's claimed that Marsha had thrown a brick at a police officer, an account that was never verified either. Marsha also confirmed not being present at the Stonewall Inn when the rioting initially broke out, but instead had heard about it, went to get her BFF Sylvia Rivera, who was at a park uptown sleeping on a bench, to tell her about it, and then they, like, joined in. However, many have corroborated that on the second night, Johnson climbed up a lamppost and dropped a bag with a brick in it on a police car, shattering the windshield. Fucking love her. So, following the Stonewall Uprising, Marsha joined the Gay Liberation Front and was super active in the GLF Drag Queen Caucus. On the first anniversary, as I mentioned, of the Stonewall Rebellion, on June 28th, 1970, Marsha marched in the first gay pride rally, which was then called the Christopher Street Liberation Day. In 1973, Johnson and Rivera were banned from participating in the gay pride parade by the gay and lesbian committee who were administering the event, stating that they weren't going to allow drag queens at their marches, claiming they were giving them a bad name. So again, like, another example mm-hmm. about how even the LGBTQ plus community was not welcoming of the T part of the right. community. And they were, you know what they did? They're like, well, fuck you. We're just going to march right before your march starts. So they were like still pretty much a part of it, but just unofficially, they just started like a little early. And then like the pride rally like followed after. So one of Marsha's most notable direct actions happened in August 1970. She staged a sit-in protest at Weinstein Hall in New York University alongside fellow GLF members after administrators canceled a dance when they found out it was sponsored by gay organizations. So Marsha P. Johnson and her BFF, Sylvia, I always want to say Plath, Sylvia Rivera, the two of them became really well known at gay liberation marches and other like radical political actions. So shortly after that, Marsha and Sylvia, they co-founded the Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, or STAR, organization. And then they also started Star House. This is awesome. Star House was a shelter for gay and trans street kids in 1972. And they paid the rent for it with money they made themselves as sex workers. And they also struck up a pretty sweet deal with the landlord, Michael Umbar, who was a mafioso. Again, here's the mafia involved in the gay mm-hmm. community again. So the building was super run down. It was in desperate need of repair. So Marsha and Sylvia were like, hey, Mike, give us like super cheap rent in exchange. We're going to fix this place right up out of our own pockets. And they did. Like, they did a super good job. They renovated the renovated the place from the ground up. Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera would give the kids staying at Star House clothes, money. They advocated for their rights. It was so sweet. Marsha referred to the people staying at Star House as her children. And they, in turn, like, referred to her as the Queen Mother.
Aww, like she was... Queen Mother. My kids better fucking call me that.
Queen Mother, some breakfast, please. yeah, so she was just super, super nurturing and just, you know, naturally just always wanted to help people in need, even though she was, like, kind of herself desperately in need of as well. So right. Marsha worked to provide food, clothing, emotional support, as well as offering a sense of family for the young drag queens, trans women, gender nonconformists, and other gay street kids living on the Christopher Street docks or in the Star House on the Lower East Side of New York. Very much just like that chosen family vibe that so many LGBTQ and especially those of color need to create in their lives.
Right.
So in 1992, when George Segal's Stonewall Memorial was moved to Christopher Street to recognize the gay liberation movement, Marsha commented, quote, "How many people have died for these two little statues to be put in the park to recognize gay people? How many years does it take for people to see that we're all brothers and sisters and human beings in the human race? I mean, how many years does it take for people to see that we're all in this rat race together?" Unquote. So, a little into Marsha's health. Now, I've kind of walked through, you know, an overview of her life. As you can tell, she was living a tough lifestyle. You know, she was always in dire need of money. Obviously, she's been through some shit. Like, she was sexually assaulted as a kid. She was even shot once while living in New York. She's said to have been arrested over 100 times. Like, there's, like, an interview where she was like, "Once I hit 100, I stopped counting." Like, she was arrested so many times. Obviously engaged in survival sex, as I mentioned, living on the streets. And so it really took a toll on her mental health. She tried to keep her head above water with it. But in 1970, Marsha had her first mental breakdown. So she would walk naked up and down Christopher Street, and she was then taken away for 2 or 3 months to a psychiatric hospital. And I guess this would happen a few more times, not specifically the walking naked in the street, but just like mental right. breakdowns, needing to seek treatment. Throughout the 1980s, Marsha continued to be an active part in street activism as a respected organizer and marshal with ACT UP, which was an international grassroots political group working to end the AIDS pandemic and improve the lives of those living with AIDS. And in 1992, she did come out that she, too, was suffering from AIDS. However, AIDS was not the reason for Marsha's demise. So on July 6, 1992, shortly after that year's Pride Parade, Marsha's body was discovered floating in the Hudson River close to the West Village piers. She was 46 years old. The police arrived and they were like super quick to be like, okay, so she obviously committed suicide, case closed, done. But a ton of people, Marsha's friends and just people in the community and even just people who saw the body were like, there's no way. Just knowing Marsha, and also, you know, they noticed, you know, some circumstances of like what the body was like. They're like, this doesn't seem like a closed and shut case. So they pleaded with police. They're like, investigate this. But of course they didn't do much. Like, they asked some, they got some eyewitness statements, but they didn't like work to verify or follow up or like really clear stuff up. Some people remember Marsha had been giving away her belongings. What some people believe was a sign that she was potentially planning suicide. And then others were like, but that's just like who she was. And it wasn't like right. she was giving all her stuff away. She was just extremely charitable if someone was like, oh, like, you know, I'm so cold, she'd be like, here, here's my jacket. It's yours. You know, she was just always so generous and going out of her way for people. And she did that all the time. So they're like, that's not anything new that.
Well, and if she killed herself, are they suggesting she drowned herself?
Yeah. It's an interesting way.
Do you know how hard that is?
It's an interesting way to go. No. I mean, I know people have done it, but what she just like jumped off. It is an interesting thing. Like, it's not like she even filled her pockets with anything heavy with the intent to like exactly. make it hard. She just jumped in. It just seemed like she just jumped in.
Yeah, you can't. Your body has a natural reaction when you begin to drown to try to save itself.
Yeah.
And you either have to be completely weighed down or you need help.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have to be physically unable to get out of the water.
Yeah, like you die of exhaustion trying to stay afloat. Like,
yeah. Exactly.
And also, like, it makes me so sad because, like, it's, I don't know. Anyways, I'll get into it. So they're like, okay, she was giving away her stuff. That's not that big of a red flag. Also, as I mentioned, her BFF, Sylvia Rivera, she was like, no way. Like, yeah, she had mental health problems, but it never manifested in any suicidal talk or behavior. Not to say that there haven't been people that have completed suicide and people were like, oh, we had no idea. Like, it does happen. But
mm-hmm.
she had a lot of people who are super close to her, knew her for years. And also, this was really interesting and I'm not quite sure what this meant. But Sylvia is quoted as saying that they made a pact to cross the River Jordan, which was actually meaning the Hudson River, together. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, wait, is that a suicide pact together? Like, if, or is that like, you right. just, you're going to do life together? Because they really were like, they were right. so close. So I'm not quite sure what that means, but that's what Sylvia said. There, she's like, so she's like, there's no way.
Yeah.
We mentioned this in the murder of Donna Gentile, who was a sex worker. Throwback to episode 9. Check it out. But the reason Marsha's death wasn't looked into, I'm sure you can guess, like, she was part of the LGBTQ+ community, but she was considered NHI, which means no humans involved. And this is a term that people and police have used in investigations involving sex workers, addicts, homeless people, just pretty much anyone who society deems dirty or just less than human, which is fucking bullshit. Because they were like, okay, like, why would we care, though? I also want to make it clear, like, right. I don't know if I mentioned, but, like, Marsha was a black person. And so, like, right. that's another layer. We're like, okay, whatever. It's, like, another, you know, low-income, mm-hmm. gay, you know, person of color that's dead in New York City. Like, they just didn't give a fuck. What's tough about Marsha's case is that, not that I'm saying that they should have not given a fuck. Obviously, they should have. But it's just, right. like, we're talking about, you know, the circumstances. So that's really tough because Marsha's case, there's a lot of conflicting stories, especially about the last times that she was seen. So, all right, so there's this guy, Randy Wicker, and he was Marsha's roommate at the time. He saw her last on July 2nd, but then there's reports from people who say that they saw her on July 4th. So again, her body's discovered on the 6th. Her roommate didn't see her after the 2nd, but other people kind of saw her around on the 4th. And then there was evidence found that Marsha was seen late in the night on July 5th and that two men were following her. So again, this is the night before she's found dead. According to the eyewitness, she seemed scared and was heading towards the West Village Piers, which is where her body was later found. So there is this Netflix documentary, watch it. It's called The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson. And Randy Wicker is on that documentary. He says that he actually blames himself for Marsha's death. And here's Aww. Why. And, like, it's not really his fault. Like, he really shouldn't feel guilty. But, like, this is why. So Randy was trying to take over the Christopher Street Festival Committee, which they ran some of the events that happen at, like, gay pride events. Randy paid $5,000 out of his own pocket to hire a PI to look into the committee. Committee. Because he believed that the people who were running it were embezzling money. Oh. And he's like, I want to take control of it so it's actually run accordingly and it's not crooked and stuff. And he wasn't the only one that was suspicious of this. There were others that were suspecting that this was going on too. Randy learned that there was a threat against him. And it seemed like the mafia was somehow profiting from the event as well, or profiting from the embezzlement. So there's Victoria Cruz, who was also suspicious, had also started her own investigation to look into this. And she found out, like, also, I want to say that Victoria Cruz is also a great, another, like, awesome transgender activist of her own right. But in her investigation, mm-hmm. she found out that there was a message meant for Randy that he never got. And the message said, tell Randy what happened to Marcia will happen to him if he doesn't leave Red and Jacques alone. So very, very mob-like.
Yes.
And it seemed like perhaps Marcia's death was like a warning.
Mm-hmm.
So again, back to Marcia and the mysterious circumstances of her death. Her cause of death was initially written as a drowning, and then it was changed to undetermined causes. Investigators were able to confirm that she was definitely alive when she got in the water, but like, was she chased in? Was she conscious? Was she unconscious? We don't know. And in 2012, the case was reopened, and it's still open to this day, actually.
Good.
Yeah. So on the documentary that I mentioned, you see Victoria Cruz, she like calls in to try to get her hands on Marcia's autopsy report. But she's told by the person on the phone that it's like lost, it's incomplete, there's missing pages, like kind of like, and then you just get the sense from the attitude of this person, they're like, they just didn't give a shit either. Like it was just like weird and dodgy.
Yeah.
Victoria finally does get her hands on it. And she sits down and walks through it with Dr. Michael Bodden, who is a famous forensic pathologist known for his work investigating high-profile deaths and as the host of HBO's Autopsy. Bodden was the chief medical examiner of New York City from 1978 to 1979. So he's got major props. Also, like, if you know the podcast Morbid, Elena talks about him all the time, and Elena is a autopsy technician herself, so apparently this guy's like a badass in his field, so he knows what he's talking about. So Victoria's sitting down with him, they're going through the report and trying to kind of decipher all of the medical jargon that's on it, right? So the report says that there is a lot of discoloration throughout the body, which could be attributed to various things. I mean, it was in the water. It could have been from, like, the pooling of the blood, like, when it kind of hits the gravity. Like, it wasn't necessarily, like, bruises or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that there were a lot of hemorrhages in her brain, which is weird because hemorrhages usually can indicate some sort of, like, head trauma, like a concussion, right, or something like that. But Dr. Bodden says that as the autopsy stands, an assault is ruled out because there are no signs of any trauma or impact to the body. This is as noted in the autopsy. But people who saw Marcia's body said that they saw a massive wound on the back of her head, and it wasn't noted on the autopsy. And not that it was like, oh, like there was a bloody, you know, her head was bloody. Like the person who saw this was like, it was a hole in her head. Mm-hmm. A hole in her head. So two possible scenarios based on the report is that she was chased or forced into the water somehow, or that she indeed wanted to complete suicide and just jumped in of her own accord, which if you're asking me is the less likely case.
Yeah.
The wound witness on Marcia's head, Dr. Bodden explains it could be due to skin deteriorating in the water. causing it to, like, it basically, like, becomes really paper thin and it disintegrates really easily and falls apart. And this could, you know, in like, the decomposing, especially if it was warmer water in summertime, it could have been from that. But if the person, but, like, it's not noted or detailed at all, like, whatsoever on the report. So he's like, I can't say, like, what it's from, but, like, that can happen. But if it's a hole in the head, like, that doesn't...
Was she found face down or face up?
I'm not quite sure, actually.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I'll look that up, though, because I'm curious. But, yeah, because I don't know if it was, like, people saw it from the water when, if she was face down, or if they saw it, like, when they pulled her out or something. I'm not quite sure. But, yeah, the witnesses were adamant that this was, like, a hole in her head, and water does not disintegrate bone like that.
Right.
So what caused it, and why was it not noted? Like, there's no blunt force trauma or anything noted on the autopsy report. Also, mind you, it's, like, apparently incomplete. There's pages missing. Why are there pages missing? Yeah, so it just makes it really difficult to get the whole picture of the state of Marsha's body, unfortunately. So people in Marsha's life recall that she was extremely scared and anxious and believed the mob was after her in her last weeks leading up to her death. According to an eyewitness, Marsha did get in a car with three Italian-looking men, and that was also from the night before her body was discovered, which conflicts with the previous eyewitness account that I said that she was seen chased by two men.
Right.
So was it like she was being, which one is it? Was she being chased on foot by two men, or did she get in a car with three men? Did both happen? How do those timelines match up? Like, they did not follow up with any of this at all.
Yeah.
They just collected what people said, didn't really follow up or try to, like, verify, just, like, what a shit show. It just wasn't properly investigated enough to clear up all these contradictions. Mm-hmm. If you're asking me, I'm speculating that Marsha's death was a homicide. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it, especially if, like, there's the whole message. This message, like, literally says, what happened to Marsha is going to happen to you. To Randy.
Right.
You got the mob involved. There's so many incomplete facts that it makes me wonder, like, not only were the police disinterested in the death of a member of the LGBTQ plus community, perhaps they were also bought off by the mob to seem disinterested and not.
Totally. You know,
like, if they had them bought off to, like, tip off for their bars and stuff for raids, you know, dirty cops exist.
yeah.
So, aside from the obvious mystery surrounding Marsha's death, there is no denying that she is one of the most influential people in the LGBTQ plus history. She is remembered and revered by so many. Governor Cuomo announced that the East River Park will be renamed in honor of Marsha P. Johnson.
Love that.
And that's it. That's all I have. I'm sorry I don't have more answers for you or more of, like, the true crime stuff. But happy Pride! And what the fuck NYPD in the 60s, in the 90s?
I mean, and now.
And now, too.
And all cops. I mean, we've shared some stories.
Yeah.
That I think should leave us not at all surprised. You know, had she been straight and white and Christian, they would have had that down by the end of the day.
Oh, yeah.
They would have known.
But. For sure.
Dang.
But yeah. But happy Pride, everyone.
Happy Pride.
And thank you, Marsha P. Johnson, for all that you did. And it's so funny, too, that she, like, wasn't really, like, famous. She didn't, like, gain her, like, world-renowned fame until, like, after her death, which I think is funny how that kind of works out sometimes.
Oh, yeah. An artist of a different kind.
Yes. Yeah.
Unfortunately, my topic is not very on theme.
Oh, that's okay. We didn't, like, decide ahead of time for it to be Pride-themed. I just, like, I've been wanting to cover Marsha P. Johnson for a while, just because I love those kind of mysterious deaths. I don't love that they happened, but I love hearing about them.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure you saw me at one point. I pulled my phone over. I made a note because it inspired me for another story.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's just so intriguing. Like, it's just like, we want the answers. Like, you know, yep. If I were a better internet sleuth, I'd be all up in that. But yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you have for us today?
The gin.
Yes!
No big deal. Just the gin.
Oh my gosh, I
figured
I
wanted to cover the gin because I think we've talked about the gin. A lot of people talk about the gin. And I think the gin are very misunderstood by most non-Islamic people.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an idea of the jinn, and then in doing my research, I learned a lot. Not all of it surprising, some of it kind of was.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I didn't I want to end the misinformation regarding the jinn.
All right.
And I saw this commercial for a documentary that was supposed to be about the djinn, and it was equating the djinn and shadow people. And I said, all right, that's my topic.
All
Let's
right.
actually cover these folks. So the djinn, the official spelling for djinn, by the way, is J-I-N-N.
Mm-hmm.
So djinn is actually the plural. And if you're talking about just one, it's Jinni.
Jinni?
Jinni. J-I-N-N-I.
Okay.
And this is also where we get the word genie.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
It makes sense. They're not quite like a genie, but that's the name. And so the jinn that some people use with the D, the D-J-I-N-N,
yeah,
is the romanized version.
Gotcha.
And genie is the anglicized version.
Yeah. Okay.
So, but officially J-I-N-N, please. Jinn. It is an Arabic word with Semitic roots,
mm-hmm.
meaning it comes from a family of languages that includes Hebrew, Arabic, and Aramaic, and certain ancient languages such as Phoenician and Akkadian. Basically, the main subgroup of the Afro-Asiatic family.
Cool.
If any of that makes sense
yeah.
to people, I found that fascinating and I like that. And so the jinn are written about in pre-Islamic Arabic mythology. And then they show up later again in Islamic mythology and theology.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. So their existence would later be further acknowledged in, like, official Islam, which indicated that, like, human beings would have to face eventual salvation and damnation. So I'm not going to go into whole history of, like, Islam and what that is. Mm-hmm. Just, like, that's one of their basic, very similar to Christianity in that
right.
we go to heaven or hell. So yeah. In Islam, it's believed that the jinn face the same fate at the end of life.
Okay.
So the exact origins of the jinn or belief in the jinn aren't entirely clear.
Mm-hmm.
There are several stories. There's a popular belief that they were a creation of God and that he created them the same time he created angels.
Oh.
And they were given dominion over the earth until God created Adam.
Oh.
And then once Adam was made, mm-hmm. God told the angels and the jinn that they had to, quote, bow to Adam and allow him dominion of the earth, essentially.
So he evicted them.
In a way, yeah. And so supposedly, you know, the jinn didn't like that, and that's why the jinn do what they do.
Oh, so they're just, like, really butthurt for eternity?
Yeah, that's one belief.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, this is something that goes really far back. Like I've said, there's a lot of different stories written about them. So there's a lot of different beliefs. And it did change from mythology into another form of
mythology yeah. into a theology, an official belief. So it's going to be kind of all over the place.
Gotcha.
Some scholars in the Middle East have said that they believe they originated as malevolent spirits residing in deserts and unclean places who often took the form of animals.
Oh.
But other scholars hold that they were originally pagan nature deities who gradually became marginalized as other deities took greater importance. But this theory is not as popular.
Okay.
So in an Islamic context, the term jinn is used for both a collective mm-hmm. designation for any spiritual, natural, supernatural creature, mm-hmm. and also to refer to a specific type of supernatural creature.
Okay.
And that means that in some cases, jinn are sometimes mentioned along with devils or mm-hmm. demons. Mm-hmm. So both devils and jinn feature a lot in Islamic folklore and are both held responsible for misfortune, possession, and diseases. So they would both get blamed. Now, the jinn, especially through their association with magic, have also been favorite figures in North African, Egyptian, Syrian, Persian, and Turkish folklore.
Okay.
And obviously they show up in popular literature in those areas. The one that we probably all know of is The Thousand and One Nights.
Yes.
AKA The Story of Aladdin.
Yes.
But like not a big blue guy who grants you wishes.
And has the humor of Robin Williams. May he rest in peace.
Yeah, I still don't recognize Will Smith's genie. Sorry.
Yeah, no.
I don't dislike Will Smith. I just that wasn't it for me.
It was, yeah, it was
hard.
Yeah,
it was hard. Yeah.
Can I just say though, I love that they gave Jasmine her own song in the yes. live action. Thank you very much.
I did really like that they did that for her. I like Guy Ritchie, but I wish he wasn't the one who directed it.
Mm-hmm.
He's much better at sticking to the like British, what's that genre called? Not necessarily crime, but like kind of fast moving
yeah.
rock and roller type. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the djinn. So I mentioned the areas where the djinn have been, you know, known in, mm-hmm. but they've also made their way to India and Indonesia, where they've entered in through basically the Muslim way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And they have made it through by way of the Quranic descriptions in Arabic literature. So there's an influence that kind of crossed over.
Okay.
So this belief in jinn has kind of, it's spread a bit. And they're not a strictly Islamic concept, though that's really where their roots come from. They may represent several pagan beliefs integrated into Islam, but also pagans just within that geographical area. And I'm using pagans just to mean like any other pre-Islamic religious belief.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Before there was a formal theology to follow.
Okay.
So like humans, the jinn are created with a... I'll make sure I spell it, say that right. Fitra, a sense of purity. Mm-hmm. So like in Christianity, there's that the absence of original sin.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get baptized because, like, you're born into sin. But, like, in Islam, you know, you're pure when you were created. But they were born neither as believers nor as unbelievers, but their attitude depended on whether they accepted God's guidance. if that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay.
There are also classes of djinn.
Oh. It's like this whole underground society we never knew of. They need to make a Downton Abbey, but with djinn.
Right? So first is the ghoul, which is G-H-U-L, and they are considered treacherous spirits of changing shape.
I'm sure that's where we get the word ghoul from, right?
Probably. I didn't look into it because I just kind of assumed, but
yeah,
I should have. There's also the sila, which are treacherous spirits of invariable form.
Mm.
And then this one, this is not a great depiction, but if you've watched, I can't remember if it's season 4 or season 5 of True Blood.
Okay.
There's something called the ifrit.
Uh-huh.
It might have a different pronunciation because the True Blood's not known for their accuracy with saying things. You know, they said Samhain, guys.
Did they? I haven't gotten to that part.
They did that. So anyway, the ifrit in True Blood, it showed up as this like smoke fire monster, but they're known to be diabolic evil spirits.
Okay.
To like kind of fit in a way. So I think most people, when they think of djinn, they're either thinking of like happy genies that grant wishes or these demonic type entities. But there are also a lot of depictions of djinn that are just supportive or just benevolent.
Yeah.
Or like they don't really give a shit. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of there.
Okay.
So they're mentioned frequently in magical works throughout the Islamic world, because in the Islamic world there is this kind of like with the Jewish belief, there's kind of a sense of magic that goes along with it.
Yeah.
That I just fucking love. And they're mentioned to be something that's summoned and bound to a sorcerer.
Okay.
Which is slightly still not a great depiction, but if you've watched The Witcher, the first season, Yennefer tries to bring the djinn into her as if she's the vessel. Somewhat similar to that, but also not.
Actually, that's so funny. I was thinking exactly of that when you brought up that you were going to do the djinn. Was that scene? Yeah.
Exactly that. I mean, first Geralt just wants the djinn because he wants to sleep.
Yes.
I always pair Geralt and Graham as like very similar beings.
I just want some peace and quiet. Let me sleep.
Exactly. So that does bring up, I mean, in that show, it's depicted as kind of like a shadow, but like a very faint shadow.
Mm-hmm.
So djinns are considered to be, they can show up as shadows, they can show up as flame, they can show up as air, smoke, but they're also capable of assuming the form of a human or an animal.
So they could show up as literally anything.
Yes, anything. And they're said to dwell in like inanimate objects, like stones, trees, ruins,
a lamp,
under the earth, in the air, fire, a lamp, exactly. What's really interesting is of all these different forms they can take, when they turn into an animal, supposedly their preferred forms are snakes and dogs.
Oh, interesting.
No idea why, but that's what we got.
All right.
There are reports of some djinn that fly.
Mm-hmm.
And the reports of these flying djinn are actually very similar to reports of Mothman.
Oh, really?
But these djinn also, when people have reported them or like you read about them, they are also said to just not be concerned with us at all.
Okay.
So I don't know if we had like a rogue djinn that became Mothman that was like, I kind of care.
I care a lot.
So what's really interesting is obviously this is something that comes from a mythology
it did make its way into theology, but generally people tend to leave things at that and just like say, hey, that makes kind of a cool story. But in modern times, there are scholars who study these as if they are legitimate and that we need to understand them. So the smokeless fire that most jinn supposedly take the form of has been theorized to actually be plasma or just pure energy.
Whoa.
And that's what these beings are created out of, whereas they believe angels are considered to be entities that are made out of pure light.
Wow. Okay.
And I almost included a little bit about the difference between pure energy and pure light, and I was like, no, that's too far, Laura. Let's just stop right there.
Yeah, just everyone watch his Dark Materials. I'm just kidding. Have you seen that, by the way?
No.
Oh, it's so good. Great show. Highly recommend.
Nice plug. We're not getting paid for it.
No. You're welcome, HBO. She means it.
So that, to me, was like the most fascinating part of my research, was to find out that people are like really going deep into like, no, these are real, and this is what they are. Mm-hmm. So we know they can take the form of anything. The idea is that they live kind of in another dimension alongside us, maybe, or we just mm-hmm. don't usually see them.
Yeah.
But they do apparently possess the bodily needs of human beings. And that means they can also be killed, but they are free from all physical restraints.
What does that mean?
It's like they can be killed, but they can't.
What?
Like, they can be killed, but good luck.
But it's really, really hard to.
Yes. Kind of like if it was a superhero, it's got like strength and armor level 10, and there's like one special weapon to kill it.
Yes. Okay. An Achilles heel.
I just don't know what that is.
But if they have the same needs as us, so they like eat and poo and pee as us and get hungry and get thirsty and need to sleep, is that the thought?
Apparently. Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe just in their own little way, and what they eat.
Do they have families? Do they have friends?
I believe so.
Oh.
They're like a whole, like a race.
Yeah. Okay, so they're like an underground race of beings.
Yes.
That not everyone believes in. And only some of us.
Yes.
Are searching out. Interesting.
Yes. Yeah. And, it's a wild world delving into the belief in the jinn. And also, like, it's wild to me the difference between someone who is from that region of the world, mm-hmm. who is a scholar and is studying this, versus a white American trying to study it.
Mm-hmm.
Vastly different.
I bet. I guess it's...
Vastly, vastly different.
I guess it's... pretty similar to like their version of the Fae, no? Like that region's version of the Fae, like, because like the Fae, like they, you know, need nourishment and everything like we do,
right?
But they kind of live in this other dimension, but they enter ours at some point, and you know, they kind of are these beings that are in parallel with us.
Yeah, again, yet another like a race that exists that. You know, for the most part, you want to stay away from, but then some people say like, well, some aren't so bad. And
right.
There are some fae that they say can attach to families, like brownies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's similar, but also a little different because the fae have more of a physical appearance, whereas these are fluid.
Right. That's the thing I can't get over, because it feels like they're more like spirits in the way that they're described, the way they manifest.
Right.
But.
And they're also like.
Or like shape shifty.
Like very, very much so. And the accounts of them are also just super interesting, because the Fae, it's kind of like they can capture you and keep you forever. They, you know, they can do these bad things, but not like the Jinn. The Jinn are said to
for the most part, not all of them, but that they like to punish humans. They like to punish them for any harm that they've done to the djinn, intentionally or unintentionally. Whereas, like, if you fall into a fae circle, like, okay, you're gone. You know? But, like, mm-hmm. the djinn, they wanna torture you. They wanna make you pay, and they like it.
Oh, boy.
And they're supposedly responsible for, you know, diseases.
Oh.
And creating accidents. And it's said that, you know, with the proper magical knowledge, mm-hmm. you could exploit the djinn to your advantage, but it's a very, like, magical type of thing.
Okay.
Not like the average person would be able to do this. And I don't know that that is a occurrence with the fae, that you can exploit them.
Okay.
So... this is also kind of, I mean, not interesting, but still kind of. So the djinn were kind of worshipped to some degree by a lot of Arabs during the pre-Islamic period.
Oh.
But unlike gods, they were not regarded as immortal.
Gotcha. Okay.
So kind of like that's, I mean, like people, well, I don't know. I mean, people of like the Christian faith will do that with certain like saints and angels and things like that, but yeah. they are regarded as immortal. Like, they are what they are, mm-hmm. and they'll be that forever. Whereas these people were worshiping them knowing that, no, they're going to die someday.
Interesting. Okay.
So, essentially, their mortality ranks them lower than gods, and yet still played more importance in the everyday life of pre-Islamic Arabs than the gods themselves did.
Hmm. Huh. Okay. Really interesting. Right?
It's I almost feel like it's because they were closer to them.
Yeah.
They felt like there was more of like a closer influence on their life.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, just like a lower level, not so much mm-hmm. deity, but just a lower level kind of being, spiritual being.
Right. That could affect you.
Yeah.
Positively or negatively, kind of depends. And it's a common Arabian belief that soothsayers, pre-Islamic philosophers, and poets were all inspired by the djinn.
Oh.
And that even Muhammad originally feared that his revelations might be the work of the djinn.
What?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
And there is an Arab poet. So I'm getting real close to my camera to read this. So an Arab poet, Kuthayir Azah, of the Umayyad period, which was 661 to 750, so like hella old,
mm-hmm.
once described how he became a poet. He said, "One day, a man on horseback came to me until he was next to me. I looked at him. He was bizarre, a man made out of brass.
What?
He said to me, 'Recite some poetry.' Then he recited poetry to me. I said, 'Who are you?' He said, 'I am your double from the djinn.' And what? That is how I started reciting poetry."
What? So wait, so he gave him his ability to be a poet?
And yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Interesting. If like the djinn are trying to fuck around with humans, though, it's like, I guess that was like more of a benevolent mm-hmm. Interaction.
Almost like a curious, even.
Yeah, he's like, let me just stir the pot a little bit. I don't know. Let's just see.
Can I influence this? Can I do that?
Like, it's like they're muses.
What happens if I do this? Yeah. So, when studying the djinn, there's a name that comes up frequently in all the different stories. And there's, like, kind of an almost parallel to someone you might make the connection to. But, like, I'm not going to make the connection necessarily.
Okay.
I'm just saying. You might see it. So, his name was Iblis.
So here's two stories of Iblis as two different types of beings. So as an angel, Iblis is described as an archangel, the leader and teacher of the other angels, and a keeper of heaven. At the same time, he was the closest to the throne of God. God gave him authority over the lower heavens and the earth. Iblis is considered as a leader of those angels who battled the earthly jinn. Therefore, Iblis and his army drove the jinn to the edge of the world, Mount Kaf, and knowing about the corruption of the former earthen inhabitants, Iblis protested when he was instructed to prostrate himself before the new earthen inhabitant, that is Adam.
Okay.
So he assumed that the angels who praise God's glory day and night were superior in contrast to the mud-made man and their bodily flaws. He even regarded himself superior in comparison to the other angels, since he was one that was created from a fire. However, he was degraded by God for his arrogance. But Iblis made a request to prove that he is actually right. Therefore, God entrusted him as a tempter for humanity as long as his punishment endures, concurrently giving him a chance to redeem himself. So since Iblis does not act upon free will, but as an instrument of God, his abode in hell could be a merely temporary place until the judgment day. And after his assignment as a tempter is over, he might return to God as one of the most cherished angels. His final salvation develops from the idea of that Iblis is only an instrument of God's anger, not due to his, I did not write this part, meritorious personality, whatever that means. And one scholar compares Iblis' damnation and salvation to the situation of Benjamin, who is someone who was also accused to show people a greater meaning, but were finally not condemned in that belief of, you know, not internal damnation. So the transformation of Iblis from angelic into demonic is a reminder of God's capacity to reverse injustice, even on such a high level like that. And so this story is supposed to be both a warning and reminder that the special gifts given by God can also be taken away by him.
Okay.
So on the other hand, Iblis is also commonly placed as one of the jinn.
Okay.
And that he was one of the jinn who lived on earth during the battle of the angels. And when the angels took prisoners, Iblis was one of them and was carried to heaven. Since he, unlike the other jinn, was pious, the angels were impressed by his nobility, and Iblis was allowed to join the company of angels and was elevated to their rank. So he was equal with them.
Okay.
However, although he got the outer appearance of an angel, he was still a jinn in essence. Thus, he was able to choose when the angels and Iblis were commanded to prostrate themselves before Adam. The angels just kind of had to, and he was like, well, do I want to?
Right.
So, abusing his free will, he disobeyed the command of God, and Iblis considered himself superior because of his physical nature, constituted of fire and not clay. And God sentenced Iblis to hell forever, but granted him a favor for his former worship, that is to take revenge on humans by attempting to mislead them until the judgment day.
Okay.
And in this story, his damnation is clear, and he and his host are the first to enter hell to dwell there forever when he is not killed in a battle by, and this kind of goes into like another Islamic story, Mahdi, this is a battle thing. Okay. Anyway, they're very similar.
Okay.
Very similar stories, whether he started as an angel or he started as a jinn, but the story kind of remains the same in that he was in heaven, he and the angels were told, you know, this is my boy Adam, treat him well, and he was like, no thank you, I don't want to. And he was sentenced to hell until judgment day. So that's why I'm like, there's a parallel, but like, I'm not gonna say it. I think you'll figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah, I can kind of see the parallel.
A little different. A little different. A little
different for sure. But I love how, like, God's like, I'm going to throw him a bone and, like, let him fuck around with humans, I guess, from down below.
Like, you think you can, you know better? Here you go. Try. Which, I mean, then if you take on, like, the Christian viewpoint, he fucking does.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know.
We're talking don't play about chicken with Lucifer.
That. Yeah, don't play chicken with Lucifer. He doesn't fuck around. He
really fucking doesn't.
He knows what he's doing. If that's what you believe. So,
speaking of which, I just finished the show Lucifer on Netflix.
Would you like it?
I liked it. I still kind of wanted a little more stuff wrapped up. I wasn't a big fan of the last season. There were a few episodes where I'm like, what the fuck are they doing? Like, I feel like the writers are like, all right, we have to do X amount of episodes and we don't know how to fill them, so let's just put in this fluff.
Yeah.
Because I really liked the beginning of the season. I really liked the end, but no, the middle was kind of a shit show. But I liked how it ended.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also finished Ragnarok. It's definitely a show
worth watching. Did you like it? What did you think of it?
Oh my god, Gavin and I fucking love it.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I get, anytime I tell people to watch it, I'm like, please like it as much as me, because I feel like most people won't. I tried to get Brianna into it.
I'm obsessed with Lauritz.
Oh my god, isn't he amazing?
I fucking love him. I mean, so
he's the best ever representation of Loki.
Like, so good.
Ever.
So good. Anyways, obsessed. Yeah. Go watch those two shows, everyone. I'm just getting so many giving shout outs here, giving shout outs there. Can you tell I've been spending a lot of my time watching TV to distract myself from my real feelings?
It's a thing, and we do it, and it's fine.
Yeah. So, anyways, sorry, back to the gin.
Back to the djinn. So I included a story of someone's encounter with a djinn, because I can't just be informational. I got to be a little creepy too, right?
Yeah, we want to hear stories.
And this is going to sound a little familiar too. Oh. I haven't shared this before, but it is going to sound familiar.
Okay.
So this is a djinn story from Ghous Ahmed. I'm sorry. Mr. Ahmed.
Okay.
He writes, in deep sleep, I could feel my breathing becoming slow and prolonged under the thick duvet on a cold winter's night. Oh. I felt very comfortable and not disturbed in my peaceful sleep, mm-hmm. which doesn't happen regularly. Falling into deeper sleep, I started to dream, or I thought I was starting to dream. With my eyes suddenly opening and looking at the bedroom ceiling, I could see myself on the ceiling like a mere reflection.
Whoa.
All of a sudden, my view changed to seeing myself in bed sleeping. At that point, my view did not change, but I was floating from the ceiling down to the floor and standing against the bedroom wall opposite to my bed.
What?
Pointing towards my conscious body in bed, I started laughing, and at the same time, I could feel myself in bed and leaning against the bedroom wall. I thought to myself that this is very odd, and that I've never had a dream like this before. The weirdest thing was I was not able to move, speak, or even try to wake up. Or I thought I was asleep when in fact I was probably awake. All this was happening so smoothly, there was no opportunity for me to think about what was actually happening to me. The visions ended and I was back in bed asleep thinking it's all over, but to my surprise, I could feel pressure on my chest.
Hmm.
Pressure that was becoming unbearable slowly, finding it difficult to breathe. And I will note, this wasn't originally in English.
Okay.
So I'm trying to fix the grammar as I read it.
Gotcha.
Feeling my heartbeat slow down, I tried to move the duvet off my chest to allow me to take a breath and wake up, but to no avail. Concentrating on my breathing, I could not carry out the simple task and could feel being strangled around my neck.
Oh my god.
My consciousness fading away, I thought I would be strangled to death, and it was becoming inevitable that I would die. I thought to myself that I was dying and started shouting and screaming so that my uncle and auntie would wake up and come running into my room to help me fight off what I knew now was a djinn attacking me. Usually when I cough or talk in a normal tone, they can hear me, or I can hear them coughing and talking from their room.
Mm-hmm.
I could not understand why they weren't acknowledging my screaming and shouting for help. I tried to concentrate on the next room and could hear my uncle and auntie snoring and thought that this was a genuine attack of the djinn and I have to do something to fight it off by myself or else I'll be strangled to death. Dying in my sleep didn't seem too bad at that point because I've lived a life I was happy with and achieved some things that I wanted. If I die now, I will die with a smile on my face, but why should I give up and lose this fight with a djinn? My mind is still slightly conscious, but I cannot open my mouth, and even if I thought I could and shouted and screamed, there is no one in the world who can help me right now. Not even my uncle and aunt who are sleeping peacefully in the next room. If it's my time now to die, I may as well die as a Muslim, and the next words before death as a Muslim should be the Kalima. There's no chance left for me to live or fight off the djinn, which was winning its battle to kill me, by sitting on my chest and strangling me to death. My breathing stops, but I can still think. This is the end of me. I'm dying, so there's nothing else to do. It's my time to die and either go to heaven or hell and meet Allah, the Lord of the universe. I can do one last thing, which is to say the last words before death. And I'm not going to say them because I don't know enough about the faith to know if it's like a thing that just... If it's supposed to be a prayer. Like, I'm just not going to... He said a prayer.
Okay. Okay.
So he thought it once, he thought it twice, and then slowly he could feel his chest becoming... Oh, wait, I just went into third person. First person, Laura. Slowly I could feel my chest becoming lighter and the strangle easing off. This is working. Even if I die now, God willing, I will go to heaven. Said the prayer again. And this time, I did not have to finish off saying the kalima, and the djinn completely let go of my neck and the pressure was totally off my chest. I breathed out and took a very deep breath in, opened my eyes and started to move and felt very wet.
Oh.
My whole body was sweaty and my breathing returned to normal. He's something in another language. I thought to myself, I'm still alive. It's worked. Allah has saved me. Looking around the room, things were normal. Nothing was out of place and my duvet was still on top of me. My uncle and auntie were still asleep snoring. Thank Allah, I'm still alive. I was still tired, and it was nearly time for sunrise. I thought I will get out of bed and pray to Allah for saving me from the djinn. I prayed until sunrise, and then prayed the compulsory morning prayer, and then went back to sleep.
Wow.
So that was someone's firsthand account of their encounter with a djinn. And there were a few stories. I wanted to include his because he was someone who was Muslim,
yeah,
who had a belief in the djinn. Yeah. But there were a lot of stories of U.S. military overseas who encountered similar things. Very eerie, like hearing whispering, things moving, double checking, you know, that there's nobody there. Some stories sounded kind of ghost-like, but then they would see like a figure there that would then disappear.
Gotcha.
So just very interesting. By just, I'm going to drop some real cool facts for y'all to think about.
Drop some facts.
So, because I went a little nerdy here. Because, like,
we love nerdiness.
Think about things, right? So, the electromagnetic visual spectrum is 400 to 700 nanometers, all right? That's, like, all forms of vision. And light and energy and whatnot, right? So humans can only perceive 0.0035% of this entire spectrum.
Fuck.
Like,
so we're blind teeny, tiny little in like portion. The grand macrocosm.
Exactly. So when people say you can't always trust what you see, you don't see everything. You just can't. So if there's something in your environment that had a color that was outside of your visual range, outside of that 0.0035%, if it stood in front of you, it does not show up as being invisible.
It does not show up as being invisible.
No.
What is...
If it's outside of your visual range, it would block out the light from behind, and it would reflect light that you couldn't see and would appear dark like a shadow.
Shadow people.
Yes.
Oh my God.
So additionally, as far as we've come in the world of science and physics, when it comes to matter, you know, everyone's heard of matter, dark matter. Mm-hmm. We can only name 5% of the universe. Anything that we don't know, that other 95%, is considered dark matter. Not because it's dark, but it's because dark materials. Have no idea what it is.
I'm telling you.
it's just labeled dark because we don't know.
Yeah, like how we say the dark ages. It's because it's just not it's unknown, but like it's right? We call the dark ages because it's like not well documented. Like we don't know a ton of the history. No? Yes? I don't know. I could be wrong.
I don't know. But I certainly know that's the case for a lot of... Now there is like dark matter. There's a specific term for it, but there's a lot of things that get added to that terminology because, well, we don't know. Mm-hmm. So there's an American theoretical physicist named Michio Kaku, and they've said that
name. I'm sorry. Can we take a beat?
I like it.
What was it again?
Michio Kaku.
Okay. All right. I'm over it. Let's go. Let's do it. All right.
Theoretical physicist. So he said that he believes the multiverse of the universe is 11 dimensional. Oh. And then in string theory, they believe the multiverse is made of different dimensions, but the highest is the 11th dimension. So basically, both theoretical and string theory physics talk about the possibility of there being 11 dimensions. And they say 11 because beyond 11 dimensions, the world would become unstable. And dimensions higher than 11 would collapse to then become an 11-dimensional universe.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, like, mm-hmm. So that, all that mixed with the abundance of electromagnetic frequencies we've got going on today, with all of our technology that we've got, it's entirely possible that beings from another dimension could literally frequency hop into our dimension.
Wow. Okay.
So I wanted to end with all those little facts just with, because the Djinn, they've persisted for so long in human belief. They are similar to other things that we believe in. And reports of them aren't really slowing down. And, you know, I was seeing that comparison of them and shadow people. And, you know, we also talk about shadow people a lot. We don't necessarily believe that they are the Djinn. They could just be spirits. And I wanted to throw this in there just to kind of, you know, just because it shows up as a shadow doesn't mean it's the Djinn. It could be anything.
Wow.
But if you see something dark and black and whatnot, it's probably far more colorful than you would expect.
Well, I have encountered a shadow person before. I can still see her in my mind. I don't know why I knew she was feminine, but I'm just going to call her she. I don't know. It was like a sensation. But it kind of checks out if they were Djinn, like if Djinn liked to fuck around with humans. Because she was just standing in the corner of my bedroom at the time. It was when I was living with Marie and Gavin. I remember Gavin was sleeping over and we were both like restless and having nightmares all night. And I just remember looking over my shoulder and seeing her in the corner and just knowing like she's why. Mm-hmm. Just in the corner with her like glowing blue eyes looking at us.
Just chilling.
Yeah, just chilling. What's up, guys? I just knew, I'm like, you're the reason. And I just remember putting my arm around, like, over, because Gavin was asleep. I just remember putting my arm over Gavin, like, protectively. Like, he's mine. Don't give him nightmares. And that's saying something. It was, like, really weird. And it was, like, we were having nightmares of, like, the things that we fear the most.
Mm-hmm.
And Gavin rarely has nightmares. He rarely, like, I mean, I know everyone always dreams, but he very rarely ever remembers it. Even more seldom does he have nightmares that on the same night we were both having nightmares at the same time. And then when we talked about what our nightmares were the following morning, it was like our biggest fears.
Mm-hmm.
It just felt like too much of a coincidence. And then seeing that shadow person. Yeah. Anyways, interesting. Yeah.
I like the story and the theories behind them. I mean, I'm not Islamic. I'm not Muslim. I'm not Christian. So I don't necessarily, you know, follow the idea that God created angels and the jinn and then they created Adam and blah, blah, blah. But I do like the idea that there could be a being that is just testing humanity.
Yeah.
Like, not, maybe not necessarily like to do anything about it, but just trials, tribulations.
I wonder if, like, I mean, I don't know if you were ever a kid and you like to play around with worms. I don't know. Were you like, you know, you just like to like pick them up and like look at them and then you place them in a totally different area that they weren't in and just like of no consequence to you because they're just like this tiny mm-hmm. being. And I wonder if it's similar when the djinn interact with us where they're like, we're just, you know, interacting with this other thing.
These things are dumb. What are they doing?
This guy didn't even know how to write a poem before me. You're welcome. That's really cool to hear about. Like, I knew roughly like the origin of the djinn, regionally, I mean, like geographically.
Yeah.
But the whole story behind them of like their etymology is, that's pretty interesting. It's pretty cool. And I just had no idea either that they were considered mortal like we are.
Right.
It's like they're this hybrid. I think
that's a difference between like, I mean, they were supposed to be supposedly created the same time as angels. But that was a big difference. So, like, they were almost equal to them, but also not.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Very interesting. Awesome. Packed episode. I just
wanted to humanize these creatures.
Well, okay, so you mentioned that, like, the Mothman is described as a djinn sometime.
There is a djinn that has been reported that sounds similar.
Oh, okay.
To Mothman. And that was one of the theories, I believe, in our Mothman episode.
Okay. Gotcha, gotcha, gotcha.
Yeah.
Oh, well, awesome sauce. That's our episode, everyone.
Listen to it.
That was the longest pause. They're probably, like, checking, like, did it stop buffering the episode? Just, you know, a little awkward pause for y'all.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you're here, you have listened to it. And we thank you for that. So tune in next week where we'll have Witchy, which when I look on our Trello board, the topic is, it's a secret. So apparently it's not only will you guys be surprised with what we're talking about, I will be surprised as well.
Yep. Yep. I just wanted to have fun.
You know? You wanted to fuck around is what you wanted to do. Inspired by the djinn.
Just call me the djinn or Lucifer. Either one will do.
I love it. And yeah, just, I don't know, refresh your Apple Podcasts feed this weekend. at some point.
Oh, yeah, this weekend it's like the first day of summer or something.
Or something. Or,
you know, I don't know. It's something.
Yeah. So just, you know, check it out.
For, yeah, I don't know.
You like for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, I don't know. Just it's first day of summer is a good day to listen to some stuff.
Yeah. You have an awkward moment with dad on Sunday because it is Father's Day. Take a beat and just hit that refresh on whatever listening platform you use.
Yeah.
Just who knows what new episodes
double secret
are going live that day. Moving on. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening, really. We appreciate your support. Thank you so much for your understanding and patience in our little mini Mercury retrograde break. We know that we kind of announced it last minute, but we appreciate, like, you guys were like, oh my gosh, like, take a break. It's cool. Like, you're so supportive. I was like so nervous that people would be like, what the fuck? I don't know. Honestly, like, I don't know why I think that, because every single one of our listeners that I've interacted with has been nothing but sweet, but I'm just waiting for, like, the day we have, like, one person who's just like, you fucking bitch.
Ruin my Wednesday.
But yeah, anyways, thanks everyone. You've been listening to The New Witches. I'm Maria.
I'm Laura.
And you can follow us at The New Witches on social media. Support us, like our three latest patrons that we shouted out in the beginning of this episode. If you'd like to support us, support the show, visit us on patreon.com/thenewwitches. We give you exclusive benefits, bonus content, you're added to our close friends list, you get private readings, you'll get a thank you card. So yeah, check us out there. And please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. That's another really great way to support us. And finally, check out our website, thenewwitches.com. If you'd like to submit a listener story, you can do so on our contact page, or you can email us in, or email it in, thenewwitches@gmail.com. Lastly, we have a Google Voice number. Give us a ring. It does go straight to voicemail. And you have a 3-minute limit, but you can also submit your story and or question and or just saying hi at that number. And the number is 707-559-8111. I think that's the tightest outro I've ever done. So we're going to sign off. Thank y'all. We love you. Take care of each other. Stay witchy.
Keep it creepy, though.
Definitely keep it creepy. Keep it Jenny.
You have to.
Bye.